just very briefly, it's very appropriate for a school called Ashrenu that we feel so fortunate to have Rabbi Breidowitz with us today, who doesn't really need an introduction, but we want to express how grateful we are that he was able to come and that all of you were able to join today to hear what he has to say. Thank you so
much. Thank you, sir. Thank you. It's very good to see you all. Actually, maybe I do need an introduction. I've been gone for almost 5 years. I don't know if people still remember me, but I was a rabbi in Woodside for a lot of years, and it's very good to be back. Although Eretz Yisrael is the homeland of the Jewish people, and it is my personal homeland, but as a home away from home, I think Silver Spring, Washington, is still very much in our hearts, the heart of myself, the heart of Sally, who could not be here. And there's something joyous for me to come back. And indeed, Ashrenu is something that would apply to me as well as the name of the school. And I also do want to commend the idea of creating alternative schools, although Baruch Hashem, there are very, very fine schools in Washington. Virtually all of the schools are good and they have their strengths. There is always room for, you know, different types of experiments, smaller types of schools, more individual types of educational experiences. Shlomo HaMelech teaches us in the book of Proverbs, Chanoch l'nar al pi darko, you train a child according to their derech, and the Vilna Gaon explains, this is the simple meaning of the verse, that each person has their derech, each child has their personality, their orientation, their strength, and when you try to create an educational system, which almost of necessity will be to some degree a one-size-fit-all, then by definition, as Rav Yaakov Kamenetsky said, it is similar to the hotels of Sodom. There is a medrash that says, it's really a Christian bed, it's really just a variation of that story. There was only one size of a bed. If your legs were too long, we cut them, and if your legs were too short, we stretched them to the breaking point. And Rav Yaakov once described that that is really what a mass-produced educational system is. You know, on one hand, the Jewish people take justifiable pride that we were the first society in history to mandate a compulsory, publicly funded educational system. This was a takana of Yehoshua ben Gamla, who really instituted the idea that every community had to have an elementary system of education, which was not paid for by the parents, it was paid for by the population as a whole, similar exactly to a public school model. And on one hand, we can be justifiably proud of that. And yet, if you look at the Talmudic discussion, you actually see that that was a second best choice, that the optimal chinuch is v'shinantam levanecha, that the parent is directly involved in teaching the child. And when that became not so feasible because either people lacked the education, they lacked the time, they lacked the ability, so we needed to move to a school. But a school was not the optimal. Actually, if I could be a little personal, I remember the Jacobsons from Champaign-Urbana, in which you literally fulfilled to a great, great degree v'shinantam levanecha, and it's something that I still remember still, and I still admire it in that particular way. So Ashrenu, in a sense, is moving back to the original plan of kind of a small enough environment where parents are much more directly involved in the actual educational programming. So in a sense, this is the way it was. This is even pre-Rabbi Yehoshua ben Gamla, and there's a tremendous amount of strength in this type of education. Just the other week, many of you probably have heard of Rabbi Beryl Wein, very, very prominent rabbi, lecturer, who had a yeshiva in Muncie. I guess he still has a yeshiva in Muncie, but he lives most of the year in Yerushalayim. And he produces many, many recordings, digital recordings on Jewish history and biographies and the like. But his most recent series is entitled Conversations, in which he spends an hour just in a conversation with some other rabbi. It might be Rabbi Emanuel Feldman. It might be someone else. So it happened to be last week he was getting pretty far down the list. So at some point, you know, he used up everybody in Yerushalayim. So I was kind of left over. So we had a one-hour discussion. And it was very, very interesting. And I'd mentioned the fact that, you know, I grew up in Hartford, Connecticut, which was a relatively small community. And the day school I went to, most of the kids were not Shomer Shabbos at all. 70% of the kids were not even Shomer Shabbos. And there was a certain strength that you get from that type of environment. Number one, you become stronger in your own beliefs, but number two, you also learn to accept people, to talk to people where they are, as opposed to creating walls of separation. And I had mentioned one idea that occurred to me was that if you were an Orthodox Jew in those types of environments, and you would say you were a kid or a teenager, there was a sense of heroism. You know, you weren't just part of an anonymous crowd. There was a sense that you were kind of special. You were a little bit of a pioneer. You were needed for a minyan, for example. You know, now, you know, you don't even need you for a minyan. Like, you know, the most basic requirement of a Jewish warm body, you know, you kind of don't have. So, as Baruch Hashem, we become victims of our own success. As Orthodoxy has grown, and that's very, very wonderful, and more people are becoming religious, and all of the institutional frameworks and infrastructure is getting built in all sorts of communities, including different types of restaurants, as well as different types of schools, and the like. And that's wonderful, but what you lose a little bit is you lose that sense of being a pioneer, of having to take initiative, of having to, you know, you're needed, because without you, we're going to, you know, be cast adrift. So in a sense, I have a special fondness in my heart for these small-scale initiatives of schools, which are kind of recapturing and rekindling that spirit, even within the framework of what has become, Baruch Hashem, a large and well-established community. So I don't know how many people here are parents, and how many people are here for me or here for the school. I hope, you know, it's a combination of everything. But I did want to put in some good words about the school, and I wish it to have much hatzlacha and much success. I still remember a number of years ago, there was somebody who wanted to start their own school in the Washington area, and I was talking to Rabbi Merkin, and Rabbi Merkin just shook his head very sorrowfully and says, he just doesn't know what it takes to start a school. He just doesn't know. And of course, the person did find out that it turned out to be a successful venture, but the truth is, we can't even imagine. Well, the people who do this can imagine, but for people like me from the outside, we can't even imagine the difficulties of starting a school, and therefore it's a tremendous yasher kochechem for all of your efforts. The topic I think that was put down for today is some perspectives of the Exodus of the Book of Shemot and the idea of freedom. And once again, I think that's a very appropriate educational topic, simply because this is exactly the balance in education and in raising children. A child, every person really, needs freedom, needs the freedom to explore, the freedom to be creative, the freedom to become that which is within them. That when you try to artificially constrict somebody, that ultimately becomes destructive. Either they simply go off the derech, become a kid at risk, whatever that means exactly, or even if they're perfectly fine, even if they, you know, just go through life. But there's kind of a deadening of their spirit. Their spirit is just dead. They go through everything, automatic pilots, etc. And therefore, a human being needs creativity, just like a human being needs oxygen, the freedom to become what they become. But it has to be a freedom with boundaries, with direction, with some sense of constraint. You know, if you think about this, the balance between freedom and responsibility and discipline on one hand is really integral to success as a human being and integral to success and growth as a Jew, as an Eved Hashem. Consider, for example, I'm going to use some secular examples, and then we'll move into more Torah sources. I mean, consider, for example, a musician. You're a jazz musician. You love to do improv. You love to do riffs, right? So I watch somebody do all sorts of crazy, wonderful things, or I watch Picasso, you know, doing his thing. And I say, I can do that. But one doesn't realize that before you're capable of the creative improvisation, of artistic expression, there needs to be so much discipline that these jazz musicians also had to spend 6 hours a day at some point in their lives playing scales. You say, where's the creativity? You know, I don't want to do that. I want to jump to the levels of creativity. But all creativity is fostered on a mastering of craft, to put it in the most literal sense. And that's very, very much true in being a Jew as well. Ultimately, Jewish life is supposed to be about creatively developing my own individual channels with the Almighty. It is not supposed to be a one-size-fits-all. It is not supposed to be monochromatic. There is a reason why the Torah puts such an emphasis on the 12 tribes. Because you might wonder, you know, different flags, different Nisiim, different parts of Eretz Yisrael. Right? The tribes seem to be a big deal. Today we virtually have no consciousness of them. We don't even know our tribes other than Kohanim, Leviim, etc. But obviously throughout Tanakh, or at least until the exile of the 10 tribes, tribal affiliation was very, very significant. In fact, it's very interesting. In the book of Shoftim, we read about the civil war, the awful story of Pelegesh Begiva, where there was a concubine that was molested, raped, and ultimately murdered, basically, or died in the course of her abuse. And the other Shvatim demanded that the perpetrators be extradited to be judged in Yerushalayim, and the tribe of Binyamin refused to extradite, and as a result there was a civil war of all of the tribes against Binyamin. Binyamin was, of course, vastly outnumbered, and the tribe was virtually extinct. But it's very fascinating that if you look at the Ramban says it was essentially a political issue in which the tribe of Binyamin regarded themselves as a sovereign state. Very, very similar, Lahavdil, to the American Civil War, which was the issue of who was the sovereign. Is it every state is its own sovereign, and we simply have this general federal supervisory government? Or is it one nation? And the Ramban actually says this was the fight of Pelegesh Begiva, the autonomy of the Shevet versus a national identity. In fact, just to digress for a moment, I'll try to remember, get back to my point, you know, about the American Civil War. It's very, very fascinating. I am told that in journalism, in newspapers, before the Civil War, United States was a plural noun. You would say the United States were concerned, because the concept of the United States was a bunch of sovereign, in fact the word state is used for a sovereign nation, a bunch of sovereign nations who agreed to share some joint functions on a national level, and that is why secession was considered to be an option and the like. After the Civil War to the present day, the United States has become a singular noun. The United States is concerned, not are concerned, but is concerned, and the like. Now, going back to my main point, though, one might wonder, why are tribes such an important deal? There's a Jewish people. We're all Jews. Like, why should I assign any importance that I come from Reuven and someone else comes from Shimon? All right, Leviim, Kohanim, that's special. But Yehuda, Yisachar, what's the big deal? And the short answer is, this is really exactly the point. You know, each tribe had a certain sense of individuality, a different way of doing things, a different way of expressing their relationship with God. And all of them are committed to the centrality of the Mishkan, the tabernacle, the service of God. They are surrounding the tabernacle in the Midbar. But the very point is that Hashem does not want unanimity. Hashem does not want people to be the same. Hashem does not want community at the expense of diversity, but lehepach, it is precisely diversity that enhances the beauty of a community. The Medrash gives us a mashal. If you had a garden and all there was one type of flower, it would not be as beautiful as the multiplicity of flowers and colors and textures that exist in a garden. And therefore, what the Torah is telling us is, side by side with uniform commitment, Kabbalah Satorah and the like, there also has to be the flourishing of individual expression. And we see this in the confluence of the holiday of Pesach and Shavuot. You know, all of us know that Pesach is the season of our freedom, Zman Chayutenu, and Shavuot is Zman Matan Torahtenu, the season that we receive the Torah. Two different holidays, freedom versus Kabbalah Satorah. And yet we find that the two holidays are linked by the mitzvah of counting of the Omer, that you link. In fact, in many Sfarim it is actually described that the days of Sfiras HaOmer are treated as a long Chol HaMoed between the holiday of Pesach and the holiday of Shavuos. So when you tell your employer you take off Chol HaMoed, you might perhaps take a longer vacation than you might think. In fact, I even saw a theory, now it is a theory, I don't think it has any textual support, but it's a fascinating hypothesis. You know, during the Sfiras HaOmer, we observe various mourning rituals. And so the Gaonim already connected it to the deaths of the students of Rabbi Akiva, and later among Ashkenazim, it got more chomer and more chomer because of the Crusades and various other events. But somebody wanted to suggest the following. If you look at the original sources that talk about mourning rituals, they only mention two things. They don't mention weddings. They mention no haircuts, some sources actually mention no laundry, although that's a custom that did not survive, obviously. And some pointed out that those are the very restrictions that apply during Chol HaMoed. There's some positive that the original origin of the Sfiras HaOmer restrictions were not based on mourning, they were based on the Chol HaMoed of the dwelling. That's a very fascinating theory. I don't think it's I mean, I'm not aware of any source that makes that connection, but perhaps, you know, who knows? So, what is the point of joining Pesach and Shavuos? The point is very simple. Pesach is freedom. But freedom without responsibility is ultimately destructive. Pesach has its meaning. Right? Freedom is not an end of life. You know, you could say it's a wonderful thing to be free. But freedom cannot be a purpose of life. Freedom can be an enabler to achieve a purpose. But you can't say, I live to be free. Free to do what? Free to be what? And as a result, it is only Shavuos, which is the assumption of responsibility to God's law, that gives meaning to Pesach. And this is highlighted by the fact that it is one long Chanukah, it is one long Yom Tov, and that is the linkage of Sfiras HaOmer. The Gemara makes the point from a different perspective. The korban that was brought on Shavuot, on the second day of Pesach, was of course the bringing of the Omer, which was a barley offering. And on Shavuot, there was an offering of wheat that was brought. The Shtei HaLechem, two loaves of wheat. And the Gemara points out that barley in biblical times was primarily animal fodder. Presently we use it a lot in Sholent, but originally it was animal fodder. And wheat was primarily human food. Pesach without Shavuos, one is simply a wild animal. It is Shavuos that takes freedom and elevates a person to human dignity. Freedom requires responsibility to be meaningful. Otherwise, it is meaningless. In fact, I would add the following interesting thought. I think it's really speculation. Again, I don't have a particular source for this. One of the minhagim that Ashkenazic Jews had at the Pesach Seder is that, is that the first thing they eat after they finish the matzah and the maror is hard-boiled egg. Hard-boiled egg is an old Ashkenazic custom. And there are a few reasons that are given, but one of the reasons that is given is that an egg is what you give a mourner when a person, right after the levaya, a person eats a hard-boiled egg because it's an oval. It represents the changing of time, that even though now is a difficult time, but gam zeh yavor, this shall pass and life will be renewed once again. So why are you giving machal aveilim at the Seder? Seder's a happy time. So one answer is, well, we are misavel, we're mourning that we don't have the Korban Pesach. So the Seder is the make-believe substitute of the Korban Pesach. So we have to have a little nechama, that even though we haven't merited the Beit HaMikdash this year, but L'Shana Haba, we will merit it. But others point out that the reason is that the first night of Pesach, the first day of Pesach, is always the same day of the week as Tisha B'Av in the coming summer. So if the first Seder is Monday night and the first day of Pesach is Tuesday, Tisha B'Av will be Monday night, Tuesday, and the like. So why is that so? I mean, why did God? No, there are no accidents. We have to assume there's some cosmic irony involved that the Leil Yitzias Mitzrayim should be the Leil HaChorban. Like, why should that be? That seems to be not a good association. So here is my thought. Again, it's just a speculation. The first night of Pesach is the only night of Pesach that is not yet connected to Shavuos, because you don't begin counting the Omer until the second night. As a result, the first night is a celebration of pure freedom that has not yet been linked to responsibility and commitment. So the lesson indirectly is freedom that is abstracted, that is removed from responsibility and commitment, leads to destruction, that leads to Chorban. So in a sense, you could say that the hard-boiled egg is the substitute for the Sviras HaOmer that you're not going to start until the next day. Of course, you'll ask me a question, it's not a question. So how come I have a hard-boiled egg and the second Seder where I count the Omer? Okay, the answer is that because of calendrical doubt, you know, maybe it's not the beginning of the Omer. In Eretz Yisrael, you know, we don't have a hard-boiled, unless you like hard-boiled eggs. We don't have a second Seder, and we certainly don't have to eat a hard-boiled egg the second night of Pesach either. Derech Agav, one interesting minute, again, apropos of nothing, but just as I'm talking, it comes to me. There is a minute that some people have at the second day meal, the second day of Pesach and the day meal, that they actually eat a Hamantash. Of course, a Pesach that's coming back, of course. Why is that? Because that was the actual, people don't realize that much of the story of Purim happens on Pesach. As Haman was hung 11 months before the fighting of the Jews against the Persians, right? The whole fast of Esther, etc. was during Pesach time. And Haman died on the second day of Pesach. And therefore, we celebrate by Haman Tashin that celebrates the downfall of Amalek and the downfall of Haman. So Purim and Pesach. So in case you're wondering, why am I talking about Pesach? Well, like I said, Purim and Pesach are close enough in concept that I give myself poetic license to talk about these things. So this is the idea of freedom and responsibility. Now here, we know that this is the book of Shemos, of course. The book of Shemos is called the book of Geula, the book of redemption. And we know that these parshios of Yetzias Mitzrayim, Matan Torah, building a mission, are really the very trajectory of a person's spiritual life. You first have to leave your enslavers, and I'll elaborate that. And then your position to accept God's will, which is Matan Torah. And the ultimate goal is to build a dwelling place in your heart and your soul for the divine presence. All of you know the song. The song is actually based on the words of the Sefer Charedim, one of the great, great rabbis of Tzfat in the 1500s, time of the Ari, that says, "Bulvavi Mishkan Epnech." In my heart, I will build a dwelling place for Hashem. So thematically, Shemos is a progression of life. Escape the enslavers, again I'll talk about that in a moment. Accept Hashem's will in your life, Matan Torah. And the third part of Shemos is building a mishkan, building a dwelling place. V'asuli mikdash, make for Hashem a holy structure. V'shachanti b'socham, so he will dwell within the people. Not within the building, within the people. We make our heart and our soul a mishkan for Hashem. So as a result, Yetzias Mitzrayim is not only a matter of history, but it's a matter of an existential present reality, of a process that every family has to go through, every individual has to go through, at all stages of their lives. And here, we know that this idea of thinking about the Exodus is so important that it is concretized in two distinct mitzvahs. There is a daily mitzvah. Every single day we have to mention the Exodus. Right? If you look in the Art Scroll Siddur, you will see that when you read the Shema, the mitzvah of Kriya Shema is the first two parshios, Shema v'hayom Shemoah. But the third paragraph of Shema, which is about Sittis, is technically not part of Kriya Shema. It is not part of Kriya Shema. And why do we read it? So in the daytime we read it because there's a mitzvah of Sittis that reminds us of the 613 mitzvahs. But at night, there's no mitzvah of Sittis. So why do we read it at night? And so the Gemara explains, because it contains a verse
through which you fulfill an important biblical mitzvah. And that is the mitzvah of remembering verbally, not just in your mind, remembering verbally the Exodus of Egypt. Ani Hashem Elokeichem, Asher Hotzeisi Eschem Me'aretz Mitzrayim. And the Artscroll Siddur, the trusty Artscroll Siddur, tells you, have specific intention when you recite that verse to fulfill this mitzvah. And of course, once I say that, that's also why I do it in the day as well. Right? So there's a daily mitzvah. Interesting enough, I just want to point out that, you know, women are technically exempt from the mitzvah of reciting the Shema, because Kriya Shema is a time-bound commandment, because you only can do it certain times of the day, and women are generally exempt. And although there are many, many, many exceptions, Kriya Shema happens to be not one of the exceptions. Although it is proper for a woman to say the Shema, it is not an obligation. And yet, some opinions do say that a woman is obligated to mention the Exodus, because unlike the Shema, that is a 24/7 mitzvah. There's a mitzvah to do it in the day and at night, but it's not only part of the day, any time of the day, any time of night. So as a result, I want to point out la'halacha, that even if a woman is not reciting the whole Shema, she should at a minimum say the verse, or an equivalent verse, Ani Hashem Elokeichem Asher Hotzeisi Eschem Me'aretz Mitzrayim. And again, if you say the six sechiros, six things that people are supposed to remember, one of them will be Yetzias Mitzrayim, so you'll remember that. So that's the daily mitzvah. But then, once a year, we don't just have the daily mitzvah of zechira, remembrance, we have a much more elaborate mitzvah that is called Sipur, or Haggadah, a narrative. Okay, there's a daily mitzvah, and then there is an annual mitzvah. You people here do it two times a year, but again, it's an annual mitzvah. Well, it's been said, although it's really not a nice thing to say. It's not the right. It's not even the right attitude. But the joke that they like to say in Israel is that two-day Yom Tovs are Hashem's punishment for people who have not made Aliyah. I think that's incorrect, because the truth of the matter is that every opportunity to serve HaKadosh Baruch Hu through Chagim should be something that we should appreciate. Now, it could be an Eretz Yisrael because of the Kedusha, it's not needed, but where it's needed, it becomes a great opportunity. On the other hand, maybe 3-day Yom Tov. maybe so. Okay, there's more to be said for that position. But okay. Now, Rav Chaim Soloveitchik used to ask a very, very interesting question. In fact, he always opened his Seder with this question. Every single day and night of the year, I have to talk about Yetzias Mitzrayim. So what is the Torah telling me to do, Leil Pesach, that I didn't already have to do anyway? Now you might say, well, what type of question is that? I got to read the Haggadah. That's certainly something I don't have to do every night. Well, not quite true. The Torah doesn't say you have to read the Haggadah. The Haggadah is a liturgical text that was composed by the Anshei Knesset HaGdolah, the people of the Great Assembly. And as far as the Torah is concerned, you can make up your own story. So Rav Chaim's question is, insofar as the Torah is concerned, I could get by with anything. So what is the Torah telling me to do, Leil Pesach, in terms of narrative, that I didn't already have to do because of Zechira? So Rav Chaim said the following. Rav Chaim would explain that although it is indeed the case that the recitation of the Haggadah word for word is not biblically mandated, that's absolutely the case. One could be Yotzevi, if you're stranded, you didn't have a Haggadah, you would still have to talk about the Exodus, and you wouldn't, you don't have to read the magic words. But Rav Chaim said there are four structural elements that the mitzvah of Sipur entails that do not exist under the mitzvah of Zechira, and the Haggadah in turn is an elaboration and amplification of these four basic elements. And here are the four elements that Rav Chaim would list. And again, I'm going to segue back and kind of talk about how this applies to the educational experience of raising children. Element number one is the whole year I just say Hashem took us out of Egypt. Then I speak. Leil Pesach, the process must be elicited through a question and answer process. That's very important. Question and answer. The Torah itself uses the phrase Ki Yishalcha Dincha.
This, of course, is the source of the famous Manishtana, the four questions. The youngest child, even if they're 65, you know, asks it at the Seder. But once again, if you go back to the Gemara, you actually see the Manishtana is kind of a cop-out. Because ideally, what is supposed to happen is people should come with their own questions. Nebuch, you can't think of anything to ask. You're an Einar Yodea Lishol. You don't have any questions, etc. So we'll give you the questions. It's like cliff notes. It's like, you know, whatever it is. I remember many, many years ago when I was a small child, maybe 10, maybe not that small, that was shortly after Yetzias Mitzrayim, okay, one of the first sailors. Now, so the thing was that we were invited. It was not at my family's house, but we were invited to a Seder. And the kids of the house, of the other family, were very inquisitive. They were asking all sorts of questions for the Seder. So the father got a little impatient. So the father said to them, stop asking questions, we have to do the Seder. You know, kind of missing the point a little bit. So that's, I'm going to list the elements, then I'm going to go back and connect them. So element number one is that the mitzvah of Zechira does not require questions and answers, and the mitzvah of Sipor requires a process of questioning, and indeed the Gemara says, even if you are by yourself and there's no one that you're asking your questions to, you must ask questions. By the way, as an aside, forgive me for the digressions. I'm still a little jet lagged, so my mind is wandering off in different ways. You know, one of the great, great rabbis of our century was Rav Yosef Shalom El Yoshev. You may have heard of him. He died around 3 years ago at the age of 104. He lived a very, very long life, a great, great Torah scholar. He had the largest funeral in the history of Israel until Rav Avadi Yosef was there. Rav Yosef had a little larger. I think Rav Yosef had 650,000. Rav Avadi Yosef had 800,000. 150,000 here or there. But Rav Yosef, who basically is a tremendous, tremendous gaon in halacha, especially also in Makobol, although that's known. When he would learn, which is never, in fact, his schedule was that the whole day people would be asking him shaylas, so his private time was 2 a.m. to 7 a.m. before shaylas. So he would go to sleep at 10, maybe 9:30, get up at 2, and these were his hours. And when he would learn, he would say the Gemara to himself as if he'd be teaching somebody, he would say. So the Gemara asks this, and Rashi says this, and Tosfos says this. Yiddish was his spoken language, and he would literally, you know, you'd really have the impression that somebody was with him. So one of his next-door neighbors, unbeknownst to Rav Yashiv, claimed he learned all of Maseches Shabbos and Erevin just sitting next to the wall. He took out a Gemara. And he's explaining everything. So he had a private chavrusa with the gadol hador that the gadol hador was not even aware that he was doing. So that's questions and answers. Okay, that's element number one. Again, I'll go back and show you the relevance of it. So again, what are we trying to answer? What is the structural difference between the annual mitzvah of Sipor and the daily mitzvah of Zechira? Element one, she'ela u'tshuva. Element two, maschil bignus umisayem bishvach, to begin with the band. The whole year, I just cut to the chase. God took me out of Egypt, took us out of Egypt, great. Pesach night, you must begin with the bad part of the story, the negative part of the story. Now there's actually a machlokas in the Gemara. What is the negative part of the story that you're emphasizing? According to one opinion, it is the slavery of Egypt, Avadim Hayinu. According to the other opinion, it is the idolatry and the paganism that we had
before HaKadosh Baruch Hu redeemed us. And as a result, the Pesach Haggadah incorporates both storylines. It incorporates both slavery and the paganism. In fact, Rav David Cohn, a great Rav in Flatbush, actually suggests that the Gemara implies that there were two different versions of the Haggadah. There was a version A of the Haggadah that emphasized slavery to freedom, and there was a version B of the Haggadah that emphasized paganism to Avodat Hashem. And our Haggadah is an amalgamation of two versions. And what he tries to do is he tries to identify which paragraph of the Haggadah would belong to hypothetical version A and which belongs to version B. It's kind of a deconstruction, so to speak, of the Haggadah text.
Again, that's a fascinating thought, but as far as I know, even go back to the Genizer, go back to as early a source of Haggadah that we have,
we don't really find, I mean, obviously there are going to be textual differences, but we don't find fundamentally different Nuscha'ot of the Haggadah, but this is what the Rav David Cohn posits. Okay. But be it as it may, this is element two. Maschil b'gnosu b'sayim shar. Again, I'm going to go back. I just want to list them. Now, element number three is the famous statement of Rabban Gamliel that is taken from the Mishnah in Arvei Pesachim that says that anyone that does not recite or explain the significance of three commandments, the eating of the Karban Pesach, the eating of the matzah, and the eating of the maror, has not fulfilled their obligation. Now, what obligation haven't they fulfilled? So the Ran explains, you certainly fulfill the mitzvah of Korban Pesach by eating it, even if you don't explain it. You fulfill the matzah, you fulfill the maror. What you haven't fulfilled is you haven't fulfilled the mitzvah of Haggadah. That you have to somehow integrate the historical narrative with the explanation of the tangible mitzvahs. This, of course, is unique to Leil Pesach. This does not apply the rest of the year. I know that it's still early to be thinking about Pesach in earnest, and I don't want to give anyone anxiety attacks or whatever it is. But let me point out that this part of the Haggadah, the Rabban Gamliel statement, is towards the end of the Maggid, and people are going to be washing and eating shortly. So often, the women of the house, or whoever's handling the food, it doesn't have to be the women of the house, it could be a man as well, but people will get up and be going into the kitchen to get food ready. And as a result, it may be, unfortunately, that the very part of the Haggadah that is most mandatory, the person might wind up not reading. So it's very, very important. You can read it out of order, that if you're going to, if you're not going to be sitting at the table when those paragraphs are recited, that you recite them before Hamotzi, before the second cup. Again, you can recite them in Hebrew, English, you know, whatever language. The whole Haggadah can be recited in any language that you understand. But you cannot skip the Rabban Gamliel paragraphs because they are lo yasai yidei chavatah. That's exactly what it says. You are not yosei the mitzvah of Haggadah. And let me make the point that the recitation of the Haggadah, although it's a time-bound commandment, is one of the exceptions for which women are fully obligated. It's very complicated. This rule that women are exempt from time-bound commandments is actually a rule where the exceptions outnumber the rule. There is a rule with many exceptions. There are more exceptions than there are rule, but as I said before, Kriya Shema is actually covered by the rule. Haggadah is one of the many, many exceptions. Okay. So, we've mentioned so far, with some digressions, we've mentioned She'ela u'tshuva, we've mentioned Maschil b'gnus u'misayem b'shvach, and we've mentioned Rabban Gamliel, the need to explicate Pesach, Matzah, u'maror. We now come to the fourth element, which really will turn out to be the key to how we understand this whole process. And that is, Rav Chaim's son, Rav Yitzchak Zev Soloveitchik, who was known as the Brisker Rav. Why is he called the Brisker Rav? Rav Chaim was also the Brisker Rav, and Rav Chaim's grandfather was the Brisker Rav. But the answer was that Rav Yitzchak Zev was the last Rav of Brisk before the Holocaust, and therefore he was the last Brisker Rav. He lost much of his family in the Holocaust, but he came with several of his sons to Eretz Yisrael. It's interesting that, again, I just forgive the digression, but sometimes digressions are historically interesting. You know, there are two branches of the Soloveitchik family. You had Rav Chaim Soloveitchik, and Rav Chaim had two sons. Rav Chaim had three sons, but two sons who became famous in the rabbinic world. One son was Rav Moshe Soloveitchik, who came to the United States, and he became Rosh Yeshiva at the YU, and his son was the very, very famous Rav Yosef Dov Soloveitchik, who ordained maybe tens of thousands of rabbis. And then the other son was Rav Yitzchak Zev Soloveitchik, the Brisker Rav, who came to Eretz Yisrael. And he now, these two branches do not talk to each other, because the Briskers in Eretz Yisrael are anti-Zionists. So it's very interesting that the Soloveitchiks in Israel are the anti-Zionists, and the Soloveitchiks in the United States are the pro-Zionists. And again, they differ about numerous other things as well, secular studies, for example, as we know. Rav Moshe Soloveitchik was a great philosopher, as well as one of the great, great poskim and gedolim, and he had a doctorate in philosophy, you know, from the University of Berlin, and he was conversant with much secular wisdom in many, many fields. The Briskers in Eretz Yisrael are very, very insular in that way. So it's an interesting family dynamic. Why did Rav Moshe Soloveitchik turn out to be relatively open to these influences, and he passed it down to his children? Some posited was the influence of his wife, who came from a more broader-based family. So it's interesting that often it might be the Rebbetzin that is the secret captain behind the ship in many, many ways. But be it as it may, the Brisker Rav was a great, great Yerei Shamayim. And the Brisker Rav said that the most difficult mitzvah, what is the most difficult mitzvah of Pesach? Now, if you are aware of what the Briskers in Eretz Yisrael do to get rid of chametz, you would have to say, chametz gotta be it. Or, the second one would be, if you look at the way they bake matzah, you just would have to be it. Hours and hours and hours, I mean, they prepare like months ahead of time, and hours and hours and hours. And, you know, it's like going into a sterile room in these hospitals where you can't, you know, it has to be a totally germ-free environment. But the Brisker Rav says, nope, that's not the hardest one. The hardest one is the mitzvah that the Haggadah itself quotes, again from a Mishnah, Chayav Adam lirot et hatzmo ki'ilu hu yatsa mimitzrayim. Every single person must feel as if they themselves were taken out of Egypt. The whole year, it is called Zachira, memory. At Leil Pesach, it is experience. And the Brisker Rav says, that's very hard. How do I experience? I can remember. How do I experience? The Brisker Rav said, that is the unique obligation of Sipur, and that is the hardest mitzvah of all. Now, interestingly enough, the Rambam, a single letter, Hebrew is such an economical language, right? One of the amazing things of Lashon HaKodesh is that a single letter can change the meaning of a term radically. In the Rambam's text of the Haggadah, instead of the phrase, Chayav Adam Liros Esatzmo. It's Chayav Adam Laharot. Hey, Laharot Esatzmo. Lirot is my own internal existential experience. I must regard myself. Laharot just means I must externally demonstrate by behavior as if I was redeemed. That includes reclining. That includes drinking four cups of wine. So like the Rambam, it's not particularly hard. In other words, just behave like you were redeemed. It's not referring to an inner state. That's the Rambam. That is a textual change of some significance. But that's not our text, right? Our text reads, Liros. Very, very hard. So, where are we so far? So far we started off with the question, Rav Chaim's question. Since every single day and night you have to mention the Exodus, What is the Torah uniquely creating for the night of Pesach? And he answered four things. Question and answer. Number one, beginning with the bat, however that's defined. Number two, explaining Pesach, Matzah, and Maror. Number three. And number four, experience rather than commemorate. And this is the building block, so to speak, upon which the text of the Haggadah was constructed. So again, the text of the Haggadah is technically a rabbinic creation. Although obviously there are many verses in the Haggadah, but the book that is called the Haggadah is a creation of the Anshei Knesset Hagdola towards the beginning of the Second Temple. Yeah, and we could argue that pre-rabbinic or rabbinic, you know, historians can put different labels on it, but it is not a Torah commandment that you have to say these particular words, but the building blocks are part of the definition of the mitzvah of Haggadah or Sefer Yetzias Mitzrayim. All right. So now, let's see what kind of perpetual relevance we can get from all of this. In other words, because I'm not just here to give you a shir about Pesach. We're looking at Pesach as kind of a lesson for life, and a lesson in the balancing of freedom and responsibility between the desire to be creative and innovative, but submitting to a discipline and a conformity at the same time. And the best way to look at this is to start from the last list, because the last factor, because that is, as I said before, that is really going to be the key of the whole problem. Every person must regard themselves as if they themselves were taken out of the Mitzrayim. Question is, what does that even mean? It's not true. I was not in Mitzrayim. I was not taken out of Mitzrayim. Now, every day in Yerushalayim, although I haven't seen it for the past year because of the troubles in Egypt, but there was a travel agency that I would walk by, and they would be advertising daily trips to Cairo. Take a bus trip to Cairo, etc. In fact, they're even Pesach in Egypt. Seems to be going in the wrong direction, but come, you know, enjoy Pesach in Egypt. Maybe the seventh day they go out to the Red Sea, and you know, who knows what happens. Now, there are two ways of looking at it. One way of looking at it is, well, maybe it's kind of the Lee Strasberg, Marlon Brando method acting. Meaning, yeah, I was never in Egypt, but I should get myself into the emotions of the moment. The Rambam actually suggests that. The Rambam says, try to visualize. That's what the Rambam says. Visualize what it's like to be a slave. Visualize what it's like to have a taskmaster beat you with a whip. Visualize what it's like to have your children thrown into the water. Meaning, again, I don't mean to be irreverent, but the Rambam essentially says, visualize. Imagine. It didn't happen. I mean, you were not taken out of Egypt. But try to remember what it may have been like, and in that way, you emotionally experience it. That's what a method actor does. A method actor tries to put themselves in the emotions of an experience, although they did not partake of that experience. But they try to emotionally live through it. That is one way of looking at it, and I cannot say that's illegitimate. Indeed, the Rambam suggests that that's what it is. However, the Sfas Emes, later Hasidic writers, offer a very different interpretation. And they say that Mitzrayim has a double meaning. Mitzrayim, of course, means ancient Egypt, not the modern Egyptian nation, but you know, the ancient Egyptians. It was a country, it was a nation, there was a pharaoh, all of that is true. But the word Mitzrayim also means limitations, constraints, constrictions, narrow places that block you as you try to move. David HaMelech says in Halam, Min HaMeitzar Karasita, from the narrow constriction I call out to God. Meitzar and Mitzrayim are the same word. A person is blocked. And what Mitzrayim means is the following idea. Every single person in their lives has their own Mitzrayim. There is the Mitzrayim of arrogance. There's the Mitzrayim of ego, of selfishness, of anger, of depression, of worthlessness, of a lack of self-esteem. There are aspects in our lives in which we become stuck. We just don't move. Maybe sometimes there was some traumatic event in our lives that just freezes us. Mm-hmm. And sometimes it's just the accumulation of the defeats of life, large and small, that make us like a stone. We just don't move. We're stuck. It's like we're trying to go through a space and it's too narrow. I can't get through it. That is Mitzrayim. And Mitzrayim can exist in all conditions. Mitzrayim can exist in poverty and enslavement, which is an external Mitzrayim. And Mitzrayim can exist even in the middle of affluence. Perhaps even more so. You know, the old saying goes, the older folk in the audience might remember, and they used to have cigarette commercials on television. You can take Salem out of the country, but you can't take the country out. No, do you remember that? Okay, it's a long time ago. And one can paraphrase that. You can take the Jew out of Mitzrayim, but it's much harder to take Mitzrayim out of the Jew. That's Mitzrayim. If I could quote certainly a non-authoritative source, Mr. T. Mr. T, you know, I guess he's still around. We don't watch him that much in Yerushalayim, but he wears gold chains, gold jewelry. So he once said something that was actually very profound, perhaps unintentionally profound, I don't know. But it struck me as, wow, this guy said something that's pretty meaningful. He was asked why he wears gold chains. And he said he does this to connect himself to his ancestors. He says his ancestors came to this country in chains, and he wants to connect himself to the chains of his ancestors. But the difference is they wore iron chains on their legs, and he wears gold chains on his neck. So what is Mr. T. Chiddush? What is his chiddush? His chiddush is that the gold chain around the neck can be every bit as enslaving as the iron chains around the leg. You can be a slave to something external, but you can be a slave to jealousy, to taiva, to materialism, to careerism, to workaholism, to whatever it is. And that's also an enslavement. That is called, that's Mitzrayim. That is a Mitzrayim. Mitzrayim can exist on all of these different levels. So the Sfas Emes explains that in Kabbalistic history, so to speak, there is never a past. Rather, everything is always reoccurring over and over again. In C.S. Mitzrayim was a spiritual power that God put into the world that enables a person to be freed from whatever his Mitzrayim is. In that particular time and place, it took them out of Mitzrayim. But it reoccurs every single year. Now, primarily around Pesach time, but in the Parshios of Shemos, it kind of reoccurs in microcosm. In which, if I tap into that spiritual energy, I can be liberated from the Mitzrayim that enslaves us. So you see what the Sfas Emes is saying? Each person must regard himself as if they are liberated from Mitzrayim. Should not be translated. Each person must regard himself as if he was freed from Egypt. But rather, each person must regard himself that the Leil HaSeder or Pesach or the Parshios of Shmos that we are reading liberates me from whatever enslaves me. That's why, I cannot look totally askance. You know, there are a lot of avant-garde Haggadahs out there, which are not halakhically sharp. You know, there's the civil rights Haggadah, there's the feminist Haggadah, all sorts of things. And I'm not endorsing any of them. You know, that's not. But I can't look totally askance at it, because to use the Seder as a prototype of liberation, freedom, and inner redemption is not a totally foreign idea. It actually resonates on a very, very deep level that Yetzias Mitzrayim itself was only a manifestation of a deeper, more profound process that God puts into the world. Now, while I certainly would not support some of the causes to which this theme is put, you know, if we have the gay liberation Haggadah or something, I think I would have to respectfully disassociate. But the notion that it goes beyond even Yetzias Mitzrayim, that Yetzias Mitzrayim is really kind of a consequence of the koach of redemption that God puts into the world, is a very deep thing. And this is what the Svasana says. That is the meaning. Each person must regard himself as if I was taken out of Mitzrayim. I tap into that cosmic koach and I become liberated from that which enslaved me. Much earlier than the Svasana, the Maharal of Prague makes a very similar point. You know, Maharal points out the idea that although the Jewish calendar is based on the moon, it's a lunar calendar, but we are a lunar calendar with a solar adjustment, meaning to say the Torah requires that the holiday of Pesach be in the spring. And since a lunar year is approximately, I'm not going to get into exact numbers, but approximately 11 days shorter, so a purely lunar calendar, Pesach would move progressively 11 days earlier and earlier and earlier. So if year one it was in April, by year two it'll be at the end of March, and year three, so eventually it'll be in February, January, and the Torah requires that it be b'chodesh ha'aviv, in the month of the spring. So because of that, we have to have 7 out of 19 years, we have an extra month of Adar Sheni that pushes Pesach there. Unlike, for example, the Islamic calendars, right? The Arabic calendar is a purely lunar calendar without any type of adjustment. And that is why, and I know this because I literally live on the boundary of West and East Jerusalem. That's where our Tzemach is. So we hear the shots in the air at wedding celebrations and everything else. We just hope that, you know, it doesn't turn out to move the bullet in the wrong direction. Ramadan, the month-long fast, can be any time of the year because it's based on a lunar calculation, and it could be summer, winter. Now obviously if I had Ramadan, I would also prefer a floating calendar because that at least gets Ramadan in the winter sometimes. But the Jewish calendar does require that Pesach be b'chodesh aviv. Maharal says, why is that so important? I mean, the Hebrew date of Yetzias Mitzrayim is the 15th of Nisan. So whenever that date falls out, that's when we celebrate. Well, when people say, oh, Pesach is early this year, Rosh Hashanah is late this year. Well, not really. Pesach is always the 15th of Nisan. Rosh Hashanah is always the 1st of Tishrei. It's not late, it's not early. It's always the right date. But the answer is early, late, vis-a-vis the solar year. But why is that important? So listen to what the Maharal says. The Maharal says that what happens in the physical world is a reflection of the spiritual powers that God is putting into the Bria. The earth responds to the vibes that are in the air. So if Pesach is a time of redemption, that is why the earth, the vegetation of the earth is released from the dormancy of the winter, which is a spring is. So the Maharal says, you can't celebrate Pesach if the earth is not yet responding, because that means the spiritual vibrations aren't there. You have to look to the very earth itself as a symbol. When is it the correct time of redemption? Now you might ask me a question, well, wait a second here. If you go to Australia or you go to South Africa, Pesach is not celebrated in the spring. Now, but the answer is Pashut. The spiritual vibrations of redemption enter the world through Eretz Israel. And then they spread. So as long as it's spring in Eretz Israel, it
It's Pesach everywhere in the world. Because it comes from there, and it spreads everywhere else.
But that's the idea, that Pesach is not just... See, if it would just be a commemoration of a historical event, so just take the Hebrew date and that's it. But if we understand it as a re-experiencing of the power of redemption, then it has to correspond with those kochot being in the Bria that enables us to tap into that tremendous power. So that's the key, which means when we read the Haggadah or we study the Parshiyos of Shmos, right? So as I indicated, the Mekubalim tell us that all of the Parshiyos in the book of Shmos are connected to the Exodus, to Zeir Anpin in a microcosm. So even though it's not the Seder, but in the sense we can experience this. There is really a double reading that we're going through. We're going through two things at once. On one hand, it is the great historical memoir of how the Jewish people came to be, how God redeemed us, God took us out of slavery, God took us out of oppression. We became a nation. And a parent lovingly recounts that story to the child who someday will say it to their child and the like. And this is the great, great bedrock of Jewish continuity. It is the national story of the Jewish people. And certainly one cannot deny that meaning. But in addition to the collective national meaning of the Haggadah, there is also a personal idiosyncratic meaning in which I try to identify that which is my enslavement, that which is my Mitzrayim, and I try to connect to the koach of liberation that God puts in to this holy day, this time, and as a result, I become free. Meaning, it is both a national story in which everybody is telling the same story, and a story which is different for each individual person. A private story, sometimes to be shared, to be sure, you can share your private stories too, and sometimes not to be shared. Right? There's something that's sometimes just for you. You know, the Alter of Kelleb was a great, great Talmud of Rabbi Saul Salatra, and he was a teacher of Torah his entire life. He taught thousands of students. There were some beautiful Torah thoughts he never told anybody. There are certain things I hold on to for myself because they give me nourishment. They give me nurturance. Not everything. No, there's such a thing as a private life, even in a public life, that one has to have as well, because it's only the preservation of a private core that enables a person to be able to give to others as well. Okay. So, starting from this fourth element, each person must regard themselves as if they themselves were taken out of Egypt. And we move to the Sfas Emes' understanding of the inner Mitzrayim. This sheds light on the inner meaning of all of the other steps as well. Okay, so what I'm doing here is I'm doing a little bit of a cross-cultural comparison, and I hope that my protagonist will allow this, because the four elements are based in Rav Chaim of Brisk, who was the great, great Litvak, Misnage. And the idea of the inner Mitzrayim is based on the Chassidus of the Sfas Emes. So essentially, what we're doing is we're using the Sfas Emes to try to explain the inner significance of Rav Chaim of Brisk's comment. But I am very, very sure that in the Olam HaEmes, in which these great, great leaders are present, that they are learning with each other and learning from each other, and therefore connecting them would not be a problem. In point of fact, even in Rav Chaim's lifetime, although the later Briskers became very anti-Hasidic, Rav Chaim had very good relations with all the Hasidim of the time, and in fact, the first Lubavitcher Yeshiva, which was started by the Rebbe Rashab of Shalom Ber, that was the father of what's called the Friedrich Rebbe. He started the first Chabad Yeshiva in, I think it was Warsaw. So he wanted to get the greatest Rosh Hashiva, who could be the greatest Rosh Hashiva of his Yeshiva. He asked Rav Chaim Soloveitchik to be Rosh Hashiva, leave Brisk and become Rosh Hashiva, and Rav Chaim was going to take the job. Rav Chaim was going to take the job to be the first Rosh Hashiva to buy into Yeshiva. What happened was the offer was withdrawn because the Hasidim went to the Rebbe Rosh Chaim and said, if you get Rav Chaim to be Rosh Hashiva, that's like having another Rebbe. You can't say, you can't do that. Because the Rebbe has to be Zaman. So regretfully, the Rosh Hashiva had to withdraw made him withdraw the invitation. So Rav Chaim was perfectly willing to be Rosh Hashiva in a Chabad Yeshiva. Okay. So, from Inner Mitzrayim, let's look at the other three things and the relevance that it would have for us every day. If we understand that Mitzrayim is not just Egypt, but it refers to those factors in my life that make me stuck, that block me, that don't let me move forward, then one would expect the idea that every step in the Haggadah is also a key towards achieving an inner spiritual liberation from my inner Mitzrayim. So let's look at each element. Element one, question and answer. The first step towards spiritual liberation is to have the willingness and the courage to ask questions. Asking questions. Somebody once asked me, in our Sameach, we have our student body are mainly Balei Tshuva, people who are beginners to Judaism, although Baruch Hashem people do stay. We offer many plans. We offer the 2-week plan, the 10-year plan. Just sign on the dotted line and we'll take care of you one way or the other. The thing is, somebody asked me this question. He says, does every Dvar Torah have to have a question? He didn't understand this. And why don't you just get up and, say your Torah teaching? Why is it always, there's a question? Why do you need a question? Just say what you want to say. But that's not the way Jews talk. Right? The Yiddish Aderach, you have a question. That's what it is. But because a question creates, even if it's a small question, at least it creates a momentary tension. Something's not right. Something doesn't fit. A little contradiction. It opens you up. You begin to think. Now, if I just hear somebody just making points, maybe I've been doing this too long, so I'm only habituated to the other derech. I don't know. But I literally don't even hear what he's saying. If there's a question, question. You're answering the question. Now I see your point. I can't see a point unless there's like a question that's being addressed or something that's being answered. A question means you want to move from one point to another. You're not just expressing your opinion. This is where I am. That's static. That's basically saying, I am this. A question means I want to go beyond where I am. I want to grow. I want to expand. And that is why there's all the difference in the world between questions that have question marks at the end and questions that have exclamation points at the end. Is the question a desire to grow, a desire to expand? Or is the question just a way of making a statement? But this is the chiluk between the Rasha and the Chacham. We have the four sons, the different types of personalities, which by the way is also a lesson that each child has to be talked to in a different way. And the Chacham says, has a very fancy question, an intellectual question, right? A Gemara Cup question. What are these different types of laws? And I want to know all about them and what the Rambam says and what Tosfos says. A very fancy, erudite question. And the Rasha says, Maha Voda Zoslachem, why are you doing this? Now, the Haggadah is very tough in him. Why are you doing it? Meaning, I don't do this stuff. Why do you do it? So he answered that in tough love. Oh, I do it because God took me out of Egypt. Right? You don't want to do it. You wouldn't have been taken out. But people ask the question, this is a very famous question, I'm sure you've discussed it in all of your Sagoda, that the Chacham also, Sagoda, he has a fancier question, but he also says that God has commanded you. He also says you. So people have many, many answers that, number one, the Chacham redeems himself by saying, Hashem, our God has commanded you. Our God. Or, unlike the Russia that seems to be saying, you're doing it and I'm not doing it,
The Chacham is simply saying God commanded you, and that was true because the commandment was given. The Chacham is not saying I'm not going to do it. He's just saying God commanded you in the sense that you were the one that got the commandment. But Rav Avi Yosef gives the simplest answer of all. The only problem is the Haggadah doesn't allude to it. And that is, if you actually look up the verses, the question of the Rasha is prefaced, Ki Yomru, when your child tells you. The question of the Chacham is, Ki Yishalcha, when your child asks you. Now again, that is a beautiful, beautiful proof. But again, I would have liked it more had the Haggadah itself quoted that part of the verse. If you're reading the Haggadah, you wouldn't know that. Maybe the lesson is you've got to look up the Pesukim. See, that's part of the lesson. In other words, there's no such thing as a bad question. If I want to learn, I want to understand, ask questions. Lo habai shal mameh, the person who is too shy to ask questions, isn't going to learn. Right? In fact, I'll tell you an interesting thing. Again, in the Or Samanit Yeshiva, I don't mean to give commercials for anything, but you know, because people are relatively new to Judaism, so many things are discussed, like how do you know there's a God, and you know, how do you know the Torah, you know, the Talmud's coming. And we get people from Mir Yeshiva, from mainstream yeshivas, who have been religious all of their lives, that show up to these classes. Now why is that so? They've been religious all their lives. Because they also have questions. But it's embarrassing. You're sitting in Mir, and you're going to ask your Rosh Yeshiva, how do I know the Torah comes from God? Apikore, shake it, get out of here. So the truth of the matter is that even people who know a lot of Torah, they've been learning a lot, and they know Gemara and everything else, sometimes the most basic questions people never discuss, and people are embarrassed to discuss. And sometimes when they ask these questions, they're not welcomed with respect. So they want to wait and hear what other people ask, you know. Okay, good. And they'll learn that particular way. It's very, very interesting that we have mamish people from mainstream yeshivas who come with the very beginners to hear certain discussions that they're never going to hear. The same thing was true many years ago when I was involved in NCSY. It was the same thing. That the NCSY group, which many of them were public school kids and the like, were able to bring up any possible question. And there were people from the yeshivas who would want to participate for Dafka, so they could learn things that they would not learn in the regular yeshiva curriculum. So that's step number one. To be spiritually liberated, you have to be willing to ask questions. You know, many of you may have heard of the famous Jewish German philosopher Franz Rosenzweig. Very, very interesting story. He was a colleague with Martin Buber. Together they translated the entire Tanakh into German. And although I cannot testify firsthand, but Chaim Leibowitz used to say that this was a work of great quality. And Rosenzweig was very interesting. You know, in those days, in the last decades of the 19th century, early decades of the 20th century, Weimar Republic and the like, Jews were not permitted, or anyone was not permitted to pursue academic careers unless they were officially members of the Lutheran Church. Now, you didn't have to believe in anything. You just had to sign a paper, and you could then go to graduate school and get a position and the like. So as a result, thousands and thousands of German Jews, this is not even Reform, they were simply converting to Christianity, but again, it wasn't a religious test at all. They didn't have to go to church, they didn't have to profess anything, but they had to sign a paper, and since their Judaism meant very little to them, so they signed this paper as well. Really, thousands and thousands of Jews simply officially converted to Christianity. So Rosenzweig, who was a brilliant student of philosophy, had a certain amount of integrity, and he decided that he was not going to sign the paper until he walked into a synagogue at least once in his life to see what Judaism was, and then he would reject it. He was fully prepared to sign the paper, but I will not reject something if I haven't seen it at least once. Okay? So, unbeknownst to him, the day that he chose was Yom Kippur, which he had never heard of. He had never heard of Yom Kippur. Okay? Unbeknownst to him, the synagogue that he chose, seemingly at random, was the only Hasidic synagogue in Berlin. means it was a very emotional service. The Yekkis are wonderful people, but even the Orthodox synagogues would tend not to be emotional. And certainly, most of the synagogues in Berlin were Reform anyway. I mean, Rosenzweig had no sense of Orthodox Reform. I mean, he didn't know anything. He didn't know what Yom Kippur was. So he walks into this Hasidic synagogue, and he sees everybody dressed in white, the men and the women, like angels. And they're davening, and they're crying, and they're sobbing. And he had such a sense of the power of the emotions that Judaism engendered that really his mind was blown away. And he said, I got to explore this. I got to look into this. There's something going on here that I don't understand. And he gave up in the short term. He gave up his academic appointments. At some point, being shanked, he was able to continue his career. But he began a journey to become a committed Jew. And he did die relatively young, multiple sclerosis, so he did not complete, one could not call him an entirely Shomer Shabbos Jew, but he became very, very observant and committed. He organized shiurim, and he organized Onik Shabbos groups in Berlin among college students and the like. And of course, his classic work, Star of Redemption, is a very, very fine book on basic Jewish philosophy. And at some point, some of his colleagues were mocking him, people that he had gone to school with. And they couldn't understand how a modern intellectual Jew who had the opportunities to be fully integrated in a broad secular society would go backwards and embrace medieval relics of a dark religion, going all the way back. And they said to him, as if this would be the ultimate insult, I bet you put on tefillin. It's kind of the stupidest thing somebody could do. And he looked at them and he said, not yet. And Joseph Telushkin points out, and I think maybe it's Prager and Telushkin in the book, the eighth, used to be eight, now I think nine questions people ask about Judaism. They got the updated, they added a question. They point out that not yet is a very, very different answer than no, although both would have been factually true. No basically says, I'm a closed book. Where I am today is what I am. Not yet acknowledges the concept of journey, the concept that life is about a process. That what you are today doesn't have to be what you'll be tomorrow. That you keep on growing. And not yet, Lushkin and Prager point out, is really a great unifier. Because everybody has to have a not yet in their lives. One person might be, I don't yet keep the Shabbos. Another person said, might be keeping Shabbos for many, many years. But maybe I don't yet, totally enjoy the spirit of Shabbos, or I don't yet keep the laws of Lashon Hara, or control my temper, or love my fellow Jew, my fellow human being. Not yet is the great bridge of Achdus that one can build with every type of Jew who sincerely wants to connect to God. We all have our not yet in life. That's our great unifier. And that is the significance of the question. Question and quest etymologically come from the same root, a quest. A quest, a search. You're searching. And therefore, be a searcher, be a seeker. Go on a journey. What do they say? That the journey is more important than even the destination. Point is, we're on a journey together. Some people are at some point, some people are at another point, but like the marathon racer says, one is not racing against anybody else. One is simply trying to beat their own best time. They're only racing against themselves. Okay, that is the first element, the significance of question and answer. And I have to say that this is not just an issue of, I hope you understand this, this is not just an issue of, the person who's not yet religious, we want him to become religious. This can apply with equal cogency, if not more so, to people who are religious all their lives. We need to keep mitzvahs, keep Shabbos, keep kosher. But are we doing so only because automatic pilot? Are we doing so only because that's what I've become habituated to?
or are we searching, trying to grow, trying to change in positive directions? Are we trying to leave our Mitzrayim and tap into the infinite powers of redemption and growth that HaKadosh Baruch Hu makes available to us? Okay, this is Derech She'ela U'Tshuva. Now let's go to element number two. Maschil Bignus. Begin with the bad and culminate in the good. So here, let's start off with a very simple question. Why? Why should I begin with the bad? Let's just talk about the good stuff. So here too, there are two answers. The simple answer, and the simple answer is true, is that it is the nature of the human being that we don't appreciate the blessings of life until we contemplate their absence or experience their absence. Those of you that were not born in the United States, and those of you that have parents who were not born in the United States, know the well-understood phenomenon that often immigrants from repressive cultures or Holocaust survivors are much stronger in their feelings of patriotism to the United States than people who were born here. When I suffered oppression, when I saw my own relatives murdered, and I come to a land of opportunity, I cherish it. I appreciate it. If, on the other hand, I had the good fortune to be born in such a land, never knowing the other side, okay, take it for granted. A person appreciates health when, God forbid, they've been through difficult illness. Sometimes we appreciate our parents only when we've lost them. It's the nature of the world that we appreciate the good only when we contemplate the bad. So the simplest reason why you've got to begin with the bad is it enhances your gratitude. I am more grateful when I go over how difficult life in Israel was. And again, that's a totally true idea. And I'm not suggesting that this is not a good explanation. But there's a little bit of a problem with it. And the problem with the explanation is that it was God himself that decreed the slavery. God told Abraham in the covenant of the parts in Parshas Lech Lecha that your children will be enslaved in a land that is not theirs for 400 years. So it's one thing, you know, if I was enslaved and somebody redeemed me, I'd be very, very grateful. But if the guy that redeemed me was the guy that put me into slavery to begin with, perhaps I would not feel so positive about it. Now, what if Hashem says, well, yeah, but you should have been there for 400 years, but I took you out after 210 years. I took you out 190 years earlier. Well, somebody takes me and throws me into prison for 400 years, and then comes back after 210 years and says, I'm letting you out 190 years early. Be grateful. I might wonder, why did you throw me in to begin with? Why should I be so grateful for that? So, once again, this last MS comes through and offers a deeper idea here. And the deeper idea is that if we were free before Egypt, then we get enslaved, and then we're free. If freedom is just putting you back to where you were, then indeed, there's nothing to be grateful for. Hey God, why did you make me a slave and then take me out of it? If all you did was put me in the same place I was before it. But rather, there's something deeper going on. And that is, the slavery itself was part of the redemptive experience. The slavery itself was part of the positive transformation of the Jewish people. In some sense, we are great. It's not only a before and after. It's not simply remember how bad the slavery is so you appreciate the freedom. But rather, the slavery itself is part of what I'm grateful for. How could that be? What am I grateful for? So let me just mention the kitzur, two ideas that the Torah itself says. Chumash itself says, about the slavery. We know
that Chazal teach us that the reason why Hashem had to take us out of Mitzrayim 190 years early was because we were sinking rapidly. We were on the 49th level of impurity, right? And if we hit level number 50, we're irredeemable. And we were hitting 49 and we were slipping. In fact, there wasn't even time, the Arizal says, when the Torah says there wasn't time to let their dough rise, they had to bake it. It doesn't just mean Paro is telling us get out. But rather, the time that it takes for dough to become chametz, 18 minutes. We don't even know what this means. We would have hit level 50, that would have been. And yet, the Gemara in Sita says that the Jewish people had some sechusim that remained with them. They didn't change their language. According to one version, they didn't intermarry. They didn't speak Lashon Hara against each other. They kept their Jewish names. Now, let me remind you, the Jews in Mitzrayim were idol worshippers, except for the tribe of Levi. They were Ofei Avodah Zarah. They did not worship God. The Jews in Mitzrayim, except for the tribe of Levi, did not practice the mitzvah of circumcision. So if they kept their Hebrew name, it was not because they were being frum. It was not because they were being religious. But it was a sense of what you might call almost pejoratively today, ethnic identification. They wanted to be known as a Jew. They wanted to be connected to their fellow Jew. They wanted to suffer with the sufferings of others and to rejoice in their joys. So what is very significant is that the ultimate merit that enabled redemption was identification with Am Yisrael, not religiosity. You know, when I lived in Chicago, some of you may know this yourself, you know, Devon Avenue used to be an all-Jewish street. Now it's mainly Indian. But when I was in Chicago, it was all Jewish. And there was a kosher-style restaurant on Devon Avenue, not kosher, called the Bagel. I'd say, I can't remember that. And I remember walking by the Bagel, and there was a sign in the window that says, we serve chalent on Shabbos with a free glass of wine for two. So, as a, you know, yeshiva student, I used to walk by, and I always, you know, I constantly, at least in my mind, mocked the meaning of that sign. Treif shalant, non-kosher wine, probably non-kosher wine. Somebody walks in handling money. Now, what type of thing? Is this, now this is gastronomic Judaism, this is nothing. But, as I get older, I begin to feel that there is something to be said for this. A person walks by, obviously he's not a Shomer Shabbos, he's far from Kashrus. He sees a sign that's going to be Chalant on Shabbos. He remembers maybe his grandmother gave him Chalant once. And he wants to connect, he doesn't have the knowledge, he doesn't have the tools, he doesn't have the background, he doesn't have the rabbi, he doesn't have the teacher. He wants to connect. He wants to do something to show that he's Jewish. That's exactly the Jews in Mitzrayim. They were idol worshippers. They wanted to hold on to a Hebrew name. They wanted to hold on to speaking Yivrit, or Lashon HaKodesh, whatever the language was exactly, called Lashon HaKodesh, and the like. Certainly, that is not the end all of redemption. The purpose of the Exodus was to get the Torah. But it is the beginning of redemption. If one does not identify with Am Yisrael, one is not worthy of being redeemed, no matter how righteous you are. So the Beis HaLevi, Rav Chaim's father, asks this question. So it seems to be that although they were in the 49th level of Tumah, what enabled their redemption was their sense of community and unity. That's what it seems to be. And yet, there is another medrash that says exactly the opposite. When Yosef died, the Jewish people said, if we were so successful, Yosef had reached the highest pinnacle of power in Egypt,
If we were so successful when we kept our separate ways, how much more successful shall we be if we assimilate, abandon our distinctiveness? Nihiyat kamitzriyim. And the Medrash says, that is why Hashem caused Paro to enslave the Jewish people, so that the Jews would realize that the more you try to deny your uniqueness, the more the nations of the world will make you remember it. So which was it? Was there achdus and community, or was there assimilation? There seems to be a contradiction. Beis HaLevi answers very precious. Until the slavery, there was assimilation. It was precisely the slavery that generated the achdus. And again, we know that, although we don't ask for oppression, but we know the Babaji Rebbe used to say, it was easier to be Jewish in Siberia than suburbia. In the sense, and again, I wish there would be an easier way, but sometimes one of the lessons of Jewish history is that when Yumo Ta'olam make us realize that we're Jewish, we come together. We come together because we know all we have is each other and HaKadosh Baruch Hu. We know that, as they say in international relations, there are only interests, there are not really friends. It's not even a Jewish saying, it's a well-known fact that nations have interests, they do not really have friendships in any type of personal way. And I'm certainly not going to get into modern Middle Eastern politics, but as you know, these are live issues that come up every day in terms of Eretz Israel and the like. So the Beis HaLevi says it was slavery that was a catalyst for unity, community, and mutual love. And this is not even unique to the Jewish experience. We often find, think about 9/11. Now again, perhaps New Yorkers get a bad rap, but New York commonly is described as very impersonal, very cold, very not caring. In the aftermath of 9/11, you know, every gruff cab driver, you know, became a hidden psychic, you know, helping people and caring about people. It happens to be that adversity can sometimes transform us in positive ways. So that's one aspect in which the idea of beginning with the bad isn't simply from the bad, I appreciate the good, but you understand that even in the negativity, there was growth. And there's another point. So that's point number one. Adversity was a catalyst for community. Point number two. This also comes up, it's very contemporary. The Torah says in 33 places, you are supposed to love the convert, love the person who embraces Judaism. Treat them with compassion and respect. But the Torah says in two of those places, you shall love the ger because you were gerim in the land of Egypt. We read it last week, one of those verses. Now, how do you translate that verse? If ger means a convert to Judaism, the verse doesn't really fit. You shall love the convert because you were converts. The answer is, sometimes you have to look at the literal meaning of the word. Ger means a convert, yeah. But ger really means a stranger. The ger is a person who comes to Judaism without family connections. In the days when much of Jewish identity was linked to ownership of land in Eretz Israel, they came without financial resources. They were friendless. They had no influence. They had no power. So, what is the Torah telling me, generally, if you generalize? When you encounter people without influence, without power, without prestige, without connections, without protection, and you're sitting on your high horse in your land, in your country, and you're financially well set, don't look down. Remember that there was a time in your collective history when you, when we, were a nobody. When we were the low man on the totem pole. When we didn't matter. When we were expendable.
use that collective memory to be the source of empathy and compassion for the downtrodden. This is a truly, truly remarkable and even revolutionary idea. You know, we live in a world where, unfortunately, there are many people who are victimized in different ways. Sexual abuse, emotional abuse, although the label of that is sometimes overused. And when a person finally tries to recover from these abusive situations, there are different ways that they respond. One way is they build a protective cocoon around themselves, which all of their psychic energy is going to, I'm not going to enable myself to be hurt again. It's almost like a lacquered shell that is around them. They want to distance themselves from the pain. They want to make it a memory of the past, which they don't want to be connected to. The Torah is telling us the opposite idea. Remember your pain. Remember your suffering. Remember what it was like. And that will be the source of your empathy and your compassion. That is why it is no accident that even the Jews that in the course of their lives, in the course of their generations, wandered very, very, very far away from the Torah. The vestigial connection to the Exodus of Egypt gave Jews a compassion for the downtrodden in every conceivable way. That's why Jews were involved in the civil rights movement in the United States, in the anti-apartheid movement in South Africa. That is why Jews became communists. Now, obviously, communism was a wrong term in world history, one that had some very tragic consequences. But at least the Jews who became communists, and there were many, there were many indeed, their motivation was almost 100% a sense of compassion for the downtrodden of the world, in which they mistakenly thought that this would be some type of panacea, some type of redemption. I will tell you that even in the state of Israel itself, when you have many misguided Jews, and they are truly misguided, who are agitating for the rights of Palestinians of self-determination and the like. Although politically, they may be going down a course of destruction. I'm not going to get into the politics. But I will not impugn their motivation. Their motivation comes from the sense of compassion for the suffering of human beings in the world. And indeed, Chazal saw this even in the drowning of the Egyptians at the Red Sea. When the angels wanted to sing a praise to Hashem, and Hashem said, now is not the time. My creatures, my creations, are drowning in the sea. So, what are we saying here? So again, we're explaining element number two. I have to kind of go back and show you I don't get lost here. And that is, beginning with the bad, culminating with the good. So our question was, why begin with the bad? One answer? Before and after. I'm remembering how bad things were. I appreciate the good. Second and deeper answer, to recognize that the bad itself is a gift that can be embraced. That the so-called bad was the catalyst for unity, and it was the catalyst for compassion for the downtrodden. When we emerged from slavery, it was not simply putting us back to where we were before the experience. If all that happened was we were at square one, we got moved, we were put back to square one, we could legitimately say to God, hey God, what am I so grateful for when you put me through this? But if we understand that these difficulties, these challenges, are transformative and redemptive, then we see we didn't come out the same way we went in. We were better. We were deeper. Can I commend to everybody to look at Viktor Frankl's classic work, Man's Search for Meaning, arising out of his own experiences in concentration camps and in the Holocaust. in which he talks about the human being has very little freedom over what will happen to him in his life. But he has ultimate freedom in how he chooses to respond. Some of you may have read a book, it's a biography written by Rebbetzin Muhammad Shein, who passed away just about 2 years ago. And this is about her father, Rabbi Yaakov Yosef Herman, called All for the Boss, because that was his motto, everything he did was for the boss, that's what we referred to, HaKadosh Baruch Hu. So she recounts a story in that book that her father came to the United States as, again, I don't remember all the details, but I believe as an 11-year-old with his parents shortly after World War I. And they couldn't make it in this country, so they sent him back. They left him alone as an 11-year-old. They set him up with a distant relative. He was working. Those years there were no child labor laws, so little kids were working in sweatshops. And they set him up with a distant relative who charged him $5 a week to rent a room. As soon as the parents left, the relative raised the rent to $10 a week. There was no way this child could meet that payment. So the child was evicted Friday afternoon. All he had with him were two rolls that he would eat for Shabbos. He spent the night in Central Park. Now granted, Central Park was probably safer then, although after Giuliani's, Central Park is actually relatively safe now, but there was a time, a long time, where you wouldn't walk into Central Park after night. And one could imagine, or maybe one cannot imagine, how frightened he was, didn't know English very well, parents weren't here, he had no roof over his head. And in those days, even in terms of Shabbos, if you didn't show up to work on Saturday, you'd have to look for a new job on Monday. What is a little boy supposed to do? You can't even imagine. What is he supposed to do? But he prayed to Hashem. And he prayed for a very interesting thing. He prayed he should have a Yeshua, he should have a Parnassa, he should be able to one day just get married and have children. Then he said, he asked Hashem, please Hashem, never let me forget what it's like to be lonely, to be abandoned. Let me hold on to these feelings my entire life so that when I meet others who are suffering, I won't know what they feel. I want to know, because what's going to happen is, in other words, he's actually saying, don't make me so successful that I forget what I'm going through. I want to remember. Remarkable. If you know the rest of the book, you know that Baruch Hashem, he did eventually become economically successful, although he lost it in the Depression, but at least until the Depression. He was quite wealthy. He married a very noble woman. And in their home was an open home. And by an open home, although they had the great rabbis who came from Europe, but he also had many, many people that we would not like as guests in our home. People who were homeless, people who were mentally deranged, people who in rages would throw hot soup or cholent on him because they didn't like what he was serving them. People who would stay in their home for months at a time. And when people would ask him, how can you live with these crazy people? He would say, I know the pain that they're going through. I know how they are suffering because I suffered. And I've never forgotten it. And that was the source of his empathy. So, the Kitzur, this lesson of remembering the bad is really the understanding, it's really Viktor Frankl's point, that from the adversity of life, we have to grow, we have to be transformed. It is precisely our encounter with challenges that make us the people that we are. We can be bitter, defeatist, hopeless, angry, or we can become compassionate, resilient, courageous, hopeful. Some of you might remember Seth and Sherry Mandel. They used to live here. And it's been 10 years already. It's been quite a long time. They lost their son. Son was a good friend of mine, not my own son. Kobe, he was playing in the beautiful caves outside of Tekoa with another classmate. And both of these children were brutally murdered by some courageous terrorists who they took on a two 12-year-old boys. And they bashed in their heads, their brains, with sharp rocks over and over and over again until these children died. And one can imagine, or maybe one cannot imagine, really, what for the Mandelas and the other families, well, I don't know the other families, so I can't speak directly, but both families went through this tremendous agony. And yet, you may know that what the Mandelas did was, they established, in memory of their son, a foundation, Kobe Mandel Foundation, that provides financial assistance, psychiatric, medical assistance, a summer camp, many, many events for the families who have been victimized by terrorism. And they took their tragedy, and they took an event in their lives that was totally evil, and they used it as the springboard for transformation and for growth in a way that they would not have done had they not gone through the very extremes. And this is what it means to see the redemptive potential, even in the darkest adversity. The way Rav Soloveitchik expresses it is, Rav Soloveitchik says that the issue of suffering should not be approached as a halachic, as a theological question. The theological question is, why did God do something? You're not going to have an answer to that. Halacha says, what are my responsibilities in a given situation? Rav Soloveitchik says, the only meaningful response to suffering is a halachic response, not a theological response. But you understand, when he says halachic, he doesn't mean Shulchan Aruch halacha, but he means halachic in the sense of, what do I do with the situation I'm in? That is a meaningful question. Why did God do something? Might be an unanswerable question. Although, there's obviously a connection. Sometimes God does something so that I will do something. But again, we don't have really final answers on that. Christopher Reeve, if I could use a non-Jewish example. Right? Hollywood actor, successful, rich, famous, Superman, suffered a paralyzing accident. Came a totally paralyzed. He did not want to live, but he could not even commit suicide because he couldn't pull the breathing tube out of his mouth. A person who was so helpless that he couldn't even kill himself. His wife, who died herself, which is a very, very courageous woman, spent the night talking to him and giving him the hope to go on. And he said later, before he died, shortly before he died, that although he would not wish his tragedy on anybody, but he liked the person that he became much more than the person he had been. Because he had learned from his suffering to care about others. Now, I'm with one other story, we still have another. Yeah, I see that. One of those, yeah. I didn't know how I would fill up 2 hours, but I think I'm going to have some. This is what happened. Leon Fleischer. The musicians here have heard of Leon Fleischer. Leon Fleischer, I think he's still alive, I'm not sure. But he was one of the great, great classical pianists in the 50s, 60s, early 70s. Great, great musician. And somehow in the mid or late 70s, he was suffering repetitive stress injury in one of his right fingers. And he was not able to continue to play. And for a while, he was doing the left-handed pieces in the classical repertoire. You know, there are 5 or 6 of them, not really enough to make a career. And he was so despondent, because music was his life. He happened to be Jewish, but he was not a practicing Jew in any way, but music was his religion, in every sense. He wanted to commit suicide. He did not want to live. But after a while, he came to the conclusion that if he could not play music, he could at least teach music. And he became one of the great, great teachers of the next generation of classical pianists. Many of them are his proteges. And he did this for 25 years. After 25 years, his wife reads that they're doing some deep tissue massage treatments in Japan, experimental treatments. And she said to him, why don't you go to Japan and see what happens? So he was, at first, he was very emphatic in saying, no, I'm not going to do it. I don't want to get my hope up. I become a teacher. I move to a new way of life. What's going to happen? I get my hope up that I might be able to play again, and then it's not going to work. I couldn't do it again. I would just kill myself. I don't even want to open up that door. But his wife convinced him to try it. So he tried it. And lo and behold, a miracle. It actually worked. And because he had been a teacher for those years, his skills had not atrophied, and he was able to play. Now, I think what happened was after 3 or 4 years, there was deterioration again, but he had 3 or 4 years that he was able to play at a professional level. Nice story, happy ending. But why am I telling you the story? I'm telling you the story not because of the happy ending, although that is a nice story, but because of Leon Fleischer himself, how he described the trajectory of his career, the going down and then going up again. And he was not a person who was particularly religious in any way. But he said, when I was at the pinnacle of my success, my life was all about me. I got the applause. I got the accolades. I got the recognition. But God wanted to teach me how to be humble. God wanted to teach me to appreciate other people's victories. God wanted to teach me how to be an enabler of other people getting the limelight and the spotlight. And therefore, he took away my talent, forcing me to go beyond myself. Until the success of my students was as dear to me as my success had been. Until their accomplishments meant more to me than whatever I had accomplished. And God said, when I had learned those lessons, he gave me back my talent. You can have your talent back. You learned what you needed to learn. I recognize, of course, that not every story, although this was a long arc, this was a 25-year story, but not every story has a neat closure, even over 25 years. But it is a perspective that we can think about. I often tell my students in our seminar, I tell people generally, that when you look for heroes in life, the heroes in life are the people, they may not be famous, they may not have accomplished anything newsworthy or notable, but the heroes of life, the gedolim of life, are the people who take the adversity that they were given, and they can live their life with hope and resilience and optimism. You know, these are life-affirming people. They walk into a room, and you just feel a certain vibrancy and a certain energy. Even if their lives are very, very difficult. This is the meaning of a great person. A great person is not necessarily a person who is famous and even a person who's accomplished a lot in the external world. They have taken the life that they have been given and they have made it something beautiful. Even if externally there wasn't so much for which they might justifiably be so happy. And these are the people you seek out. These are the people you try to be. And these are the tools that you want your children to have. And if there's any one thing that is the most precious gift that you can give a child, is this quality of resilience, of taking even the hard knocks of life and growing from them, and not allowing yourself to be crushed. In every life there are going to be hard knocks. Sometimes they could be minor. Although for a child, they're not so minor. Child wanted to get on the basketball team in seventh grade, didn't get on it. Child is heartbroken. What do you do? How do you build them up? How do you show them that this can be a springboard, right? So we do it in the on these little things. Again, as I said, for a child, it may not be so little. And that gives them the stamina and the muscles and the endurance to eventually confront, if necessary, the big things. Because we learn to do it with the little things. And that's really a parent's sacred duty.
But of course, in order for us to do it for our kids, we have to be able to do it for ourselves. See, that's the problem with parenting. You know, everybody
would love to have perfect children, but unfortunately, until we're perfect parents, we're not really a perfect children. So, gotta work on ourselves. We have to work on ourselves too. Okay. So we talked about question and answer. We talked about beginning with the bad, ending with the good. Let me just mention very quickly, Rabbi Gamliel, which is actually three steps, right? Pesach, matzah, Maror.
Let me take them in reverse order, because chronologically that's the way it is.
Maror. Remember the slavery. Remember the slavery. To achieve spiritual liberation, you have to be honest enough to acknowledge spiritual slavery. If one does not admit to themselves that there's something in my life I need to improve, then you can't be liberated from an enslavement that you're not even aware exists. The first step to being free is to know that you're a slave to something. I remember when I first moved, and this is a story that people here know because this is the neighborhood, when I first moved to Silver Spring, so I was teaching at the University of Maryland Law School, which is in Baltimore, so I had to drive every day from Silver Spring to Baltimore, 95. So you're taking the Beltway, you go 95 north, right? But if you veer off to the right, you're on 95 south. Yeah, it's obvious, but you know, my early days of driving, I was just kind of going automatic pilot. I was just following the contours of the Beltway, and all of a sudden, after half an hour, I noticed the Washington Monument, Jefferson Memorial, and I had remembered. I didn't really know the neighborhood at all, but I had remembered, gee, I never saw the Jefferson Memorial going to Baltimore before. So what's going on? But I didn't want to admit to myself that I was on the wrong. It was obvious I was on 95 South, but I didn't want to come to that conclusion because I didn't really know how to get off. I didn't know what to do, and whatever. I didn't want to be lost. So I basically, maybe the road just changes, and it's true. If you go to Florida, it does change. if I just keep on going, eventually I just make a U-turn, and I'll be fine. But what is the idea? Until you acknowledge that you are lost, you cannot take the steps to find the right way. Okay? This is, in fact, the perennial debate in husbands and wives before GPS. The GPS has made it better, but in the pre-GPS era, it took a lot for a husband to admit that he was lost. We'd have to be 2 hours out of the way before we finally broke down, as it were. All right, Baruch Hashem, that's why GPSs were certainly invented by men. So, Maror is the cognitive awareness, the honesty of saying, there are perhaps parts of me that are out of control, parts of me that are not functioning correctly. Be honest. There's something I need to work on. Something all of us have things to work on. That is Maror, the lesson of Maror. The honesty to admit to oneself that there are things that I need to improve. Now, what is matzah? Matzah, we know that matzah and chametz have the same letters, except matzah is hey, and chametz is ches. Now, a hey is simply a ches that hasn't been allowed to grow all the way. And that's exactly it. You mix flour and water. If you do nothing for 18 minutes, it becomes chametz. Chametz represents inertia, inaction. Matzah requires action. So here's the lesson. In psychology, we have, let's say,
classical psychotherapy. Then we have various behavioral therapies. I guess that might be one big divide. So psychoanalysis, you know, you certainly try to understand everything about your past. You delve into the past, you look into birth trauma and pre-birth trauma and preconception trauma, whatever it might be. And a person can be in psychotherapy like, you know, for 50 years. They understand everything about themselves. But the ultimate question is behavior. Are you willing to make the changes? So if moror is the honesty of acknowledging what it is in my personality that's not so great, matzah is the imperative of action. Seize the moment. Carpe diem. Because spiritual, Robert Hutchins was the president of the University of Chicago. He was kind of the boy wonder. He became president of the University of Chicago at the age of 25. And there were many graduate students who were older than him. And he was truly a brilliant, brilliant man. But he was, sometimes he didn't take care of his physical health, so somebody once asked him, Professor Hutchins, why don't you ever exercise or jog or whatever it is? So he says, you know, every once in a while I really feel like jogging. But I know if I lie down for a few moments, the feeling will pass. So I don't let it bother me too much. I just have to hold out a little bit. And in Ruchnius, in spirituality, it's very much the same thing. We are often very, very, very inspired. Maybe after Yom Kippur, after a Seder, on a Shabbat, sometimes just seeing our children and grandchildren. Or sitting in the park and looking at a beautiful sunset. We feel inspired. Hotel, whatever it is. But the nature of inspiration is that unless it is concretized in action, it just dissipates after a while. Inspiration is not a quality that remains in a person unless they act upon it, even in a small way. Even in a small way. So, moror is the cognitive awareness of my flaws. Matzah is the imperative of carpe diem, of taking action. Otherwise it becomes chametz, you just lose it. And then finally we have Pesach. Now Pesach has many lessons. I will just mention one lesson. And one lesson of Pesach is that the Korban Pesach cannot be brought by a sole individual. That even if I have a big appetite, and it's a tiny little lamb, you know, a newborn lamb, maybe 1 pound or something, and I can eat the whole thing myself, I must connect with other people. I either bring it with my family, or if I don't have a family, I connect. This is called the chabura. And the lesson here is that ultimately, in our own spiritual strivings, we need to be connected to others. If we're fortunate to have a family, that's great, but if not, we connect with our shul, with our yeshivas, with our friends. And friendship is not just a matter of social convenience, but friendship is spiritual fellowship, where people get together to work on themselves, to grow in Torah learning, to grow in mitzvahs, to grow in chesed. Ish esriyeyu yazoro liachiv yomar chazak. One friend gives chizuk to the other friend, and together we strengthen each other. That is friendship. So, just the kids are there for, we look at it this way. We started off with this element, we started off with our question, what is the difference between the daily mitzvah of Zechira and the annual mitzvah of Sibor? Rav Chaim gave 4 differences. Question, answer, beginning with the bad, Pesach, Matzah, Moror, Jewelry 3, and feeling as if you yourself were taken out of the train. The Sfas Emes explains, being taken out of Mitzrayim refers to being spiritually liberated from that which enslaves you in a personal level. He then went back and looked at the other 3 elements, how they impact on spiritual liberation. Question and answer. Be a seeker of wisdom. Don't simply say what I am today is what I will always be. Try to expand yourself in different ways. Beginning with the bad, see the redemptive potential, even in difficulties and adversity. Grow from your challenges,
and know that they will make you a different, they can make you a different person. Then Rabbi Gamliel, which is a trilogy, Moror, be honest with yourself that you are a slave to one thing or another. Matzah, take action. Don't just be aware, but take an action to concretize your work. And Pesach, find in your life supportive friends and family with whom you can do this inner work. And this is the mechanisms by which we emerge from our spiritual enslavement. So again, thank you so much. It was really a pleasure, and much, 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 much.